It's okay.
Meeting will come to order. I am so grateful to see so many people here at 8:15. This committee, of course, has traditionally been 2:30 in the afternoon. That was sort of a time we all liked, and so we'll get used to this first thing in the morning thing. It's also unusual to have so many new members on capital investment, and so we're delighted to have all of you at the table. And so our really early in the session, we'll do a little bit of educating about process. I happen to think that this is one of those committees that does important work for building a healthy state. I don't know how many of you attended the governor's jobs and the economy summit shortly after he was elected. I went, and I was there all day from the first speaker to the last, and listened carefully. What were the common themes among all the speakers and economists talking that day? And there was agreement about a couple of things, and that is two things that government can do for a healthy economy. One is education, and I think they did include early childhood to higher education, and the other is infrastructure. And some of that infrastructure, of course, is invisible. Let me see, Representative Erdahl is here, that wastewater infrastructure in Litchfield is pretty hidden, but when that dairy company wants to expand, it's very clear that they've got a problem. And so we have partnered with them, and I think Representative Erdahl can probably tell us the story sometime about what it meant to the dairy company there, or the port in Winona, or the airplane hangar in Thief River Falls, so that DigiKey continues to be competitive and is able to get its products to market, and it doesn't have to fall out its airplane every morning. So there are ways that we partner around keeping a healthy economy, but I think it means we have to do our jobs well and make certain that we can explain each line in the bill and its connection to our competitive state. So I'm happy to have a chance to partner with all of you in this work, and we'll begin briefly with introductions of members and staff. If you would give your name, I'm Alice Hausman. I live in St. Paul. I represent a little corner of St. Paul and also the cities of Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, and Roseville. And so I'm mostly a suburban legislator now, which is a bit of a change. And I was the ranking minority member the last 2 years with Representative Howes as the chair. Before that, for 4 years, I chaired the committee. So I've been at the table for a little while, but it's good to have new partners. So we'll just move around the table, and if you would just if your staff, give your assignment or position and member, your city or county, and if you've had prior relationship with capital investment.
My name is Deborah Fassner. I'm the committee legislative assistant and assistant to Representative Hausman.
I'm State Representative John Ward from District 10A up in Crow Wing County, Brainerd, Baxter, Pequot Lakes, Breezy Point area. And keep coming up there to recreate with us, please. We really appreciate having you up there. I have been on the committee and the Capital Investment Committee. I'm serving in my fourth term, and I was on the committee last year.
And is now the vice chair of the committee.
I'm Deb Dyson from House Research, and I work on capital investment, but also local government law.
I'm Kim Norton. I represent Rochester, the third largest city in the state and one of the fastest growing. And this is my fourth term, but first time on capital investment, and looking forward to it.
My name is Raymond Dean. I represent District 59B in Minneapolis. It includes a majority of downtown, as well as the southern part of North Minneapolis, Elliott Park, and a sliver of Bryn Mawr. And I'm a freshman, so this is my first time at a committee table. Excited to be here.
I'm Jay McNamer. I represent District 12A. I represent the counties of Wilkin, Traverse, Big Stone, Grant, Stevens, part of Polk, part of Douglas. I'm a former mayor. Now I know the importance of infrastructure.
Good morning. I'm Tim Mahoney. I'm a plumber from St. Paul. No, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I'm Joe Atkins. I'm a state representative from Invergrove Heights, Pendota Heights, Egan, and Sunfish Lake. And this is my maiden voyage on the Capital Investment Committee. So I joined some of my freshman members. I'm very happy to be here.
But you've also discovered the key thing about Representative Adkins, and that is that he'll always find the humor in the moment.
Just depends on who the humor is. Yeah.
Everybody else thought it was funny.
You know, I've always wanted to have helmet hair, but I never wanted to be a plumber.
Next time I'm going to sit on the far side of you so I get the last word.
I'm Representative Tim Mahoney. I represent District 67A, which is the northeast corner of St. Paul. I have been on the bonding committee before, but I have been off it for, I think, the last 4 years.
Karen Clark, I represent three inner city neighborhoods in South Minneapolis. I got elected the same day as Ronald Reagan, and so this makes me getting my 17th term, long time. And I've been on the bonding committee a number of years. Right now I chair the housing committee, and of course we have issues that are really important in the bonding committee.
And I just
I'm happy to be back again.
She is double booked, that she was assigned two committees at 8:15, so we'll have to share her.
Excuse me, I'll be back.
I'm Carly Moline from Hibbing. I represent the Central to Western Mesabi Iron Range in St. Louis and Itasca counties. This is my second term in the legislature, and I served on capital investments the last 2 years.
Our DFL caucus.
I'm Annie Pomeroy with DFL Research.
And we'll start with the Republican caucus, Lisa.
I'm Holly Iverson, the GOP researcher.
Hi, I'm Chris Wozenski. I represent House District 16A. We were selected in 2010.
And since we may not know what that number is, what are the communities?
That'd be Marshall is a large city, and I represent Lockup Harl, Yellow Medicine, Lyon, and Redwood County.
Craig Davis, Fillmore, and Houston Counties.
Leon Lilly, North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale. I think I'm still a Democrat, though. but happy to be over here with my friends. So, excited to be on the Youth Committee.
Dean Erdahl, I represent 18A, which is Meeker County, one township in Wright County, and four townships in McLeod. I have, it's my largest city, Litchfield, and two-thirds of the population of Hutchinson. This is my sixth term. For four terms, I have been on capital investment. And glad to be here again because I recognize the importance of what this committee can do for infrastructure, particularly in greater Minnesota.
And Representative Erdahl has been one of the leading voices on the restoration of the Capitol, and we'll obviously take that up again this year.
Madam Chair, State Representative Bob Detmer from the Forest Lake area. I also cover parts of Chisago County, Schaefer, Franconia, and then all the way down to Stillwater. And this is my first time on capital investment. I also serve on the State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs and also Ways and Means. And the first time on capital investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tony Albright from 55B, which is Prior Lake, Jordan, basically the middle third of Scott County. Freshman.
Madam Chair, Steve Green, District 2B, Northwest Minnesota, includes counties of Becker, portions of Hubbard, Clearwater, all of Manoman, Wadena, and Ottertail.
Madam Chair, David Fitzsimmons, representative from 30B, freshman, and that's Hanover, Otsego, St. Michael, Albertville, I-94. Goes through after it turns down to two lanes, so many of the people visiting Representative Ward's area stopping a traffic jam in my district.
So. I'm Bob Gunther, represent District 23A, and this is my 10th term, and my first time with capital investment. I'm looking forward to it. I have worked with wastewater and drinking water, a committee that I chaired and have been on since I've been in the legislature, so I'm looking forward to seeing your perspective up.
Madam Chair, I'm Andrew Lee, House Fiscal Staff for Capital Investment and Transportation Finance.
So new to the House as well.
No nameplate yet.
Yeah.
Good morning. My name is Matt Dean. I'm from White Bear Lake and was first elected in 2004 and served on the Capital Investment Committee as a freshman and had a two-year respite off of the committee last year, so Madam Chair and members on the opposite side of the aisle, I'm sure that you're glad to see me back on the Capital Investment Committee. And
I do remember a story or two from some of those trips we took together. Yeah. We'll repeat them at a certain
that, time. Yeah, we've had some great times, but as freshmen and new members to the committee, it's a great committee to be on because it's a bipartisan committee. There's nothing partisan about a roof leak or about building a building. It's something constructive that we can do together. Also, we travel the state, and you see portions of the state and little corners that you'd never see if you weren't on this committee. So you get a great appreciation of the state and also the people who represent it in the building, in the House and the Senate, which is a great thing. And if you think you don't have to go out on the tours, you really do, because in addition to the advantage of learning about the state and the members, you really can't tell what a good project from a bad project without looking at it. What's good on paper invariably is not good when you get there, and vice versa. So look forward to the trips around the state and learning more about all the members, particularly the new members on the committee and to the legislature and to those freshmen. Congratulations and welcome.
And Representative Dean is also the ranking minority member assigned to the committee. To the issue of travel, to help you understand how important this partnership that the state has with all of the local communities, I recall a time when Jenny Nash called one of the cities to say we would be coming to their town to visit their project, and their response to her was, I mean, very great excitement, and they said, we feel like we won the lottery. I mean, if you wonder if there's an eagerness on the part of local communities to have this partnership with the state, that expressed. Representative Dean is also one of our two architects on the committee. Both of our representative deans are architects, and so we have a professional perspective. Is there anybody else?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I got here a little late. In fact, I'm looking at my schedule, and it says Capital Investment 10 o'clock. So
that's fine.
I was lucky. I checked my emails this morning, and all of a sudden dashed in. So I got here a couple minutes late. But at any rate, Lyndon Carlson, I represent parts of Crystal, most of New Hope, part of Plymouth. Been on the Capital Investment Committee since it was created. Some of you may not realize, but years ago, the capital projects were handled by the various funding divisions as a part of the old Appropriations Committee. And then they created the Capital Investment Committee, and so been involved with capital projects going way back. For those of you that don't know me, I'm a relatively new member of the House, serving my 21st term.
Hi, I'm Jenny Nash, the committee administrator, and I was the previous committee administrator for capital investment when Representative Hausman came.
Representative Riddle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wonder if I could ask Representative Carlson if he's ever chaired the Capital Investment Committee.
No, I've never chaired the Capital Investment Committee, but I think you've accused me of having served on almost every committee in the House. But
So you've got the staff in mind. We have Republican and Democrat, the DFL, and Republican research folks, and a committee administrator, a committee LA, our fiscal analyst, our House research. We also have someone who specializes in higher education in research, and so when we come to those portions of the bill, that person will join us as well. And then I think we have only one page assigned to us so far, but we'll have two. Who do we know is our permanent staff?
My name is Karen Brunelton, and I'll be with this committee. The page is 2011, and I have to be back at the House and working with each of you.
And what committee did you do last time around?
I was on Health and Human Services Reform and the Judiciary.
And I think the others are just with us for today. Is that right? And we'll be assigned our other permanent one soon. Did we miss any staff?
Matt Gehring.
Oh, he is. Our higher ed person is here, Matt Gehring. And so we'll you're welcome to join the table, certainly, too, if you'd like. So I think we got everybody. Today, because we have so many new members, we have a little bit of a tutorial, and I would just ask Ms. Dyson to go to the table so that we can all see her. And what I would suggest, I think for the most part, you have a PowerPoint, and then you also have the information. And I think we'll just suggest that I'll be looking, if you have a question, that we interrupt as she's going through rather than go back to it. So if you've got a point you want to inquire about as she's going through, I'll just watch for hands. If that's okay, Ms. Dyson, we'll interrupt you along the way. And
Madam,
welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Deb Dyson from House Research. And as the chair just mentioned, in your folders is the information brief, just recently updated on capital investment and state bonding, and that's primarily what the presentation is based on. It worked. I was asked, as the chair said, to provide an overview of bonding this morning, and the first thing that I wanted to, I borrowed a little bit from past presentations by various people, but the first thing I wanted to cover is just a basic, what are bonds? And municipal bonds are debt securities issued by states, counties, cities, and other governmental entities to finance capital projects such as buildings, roads, sewer systems that we've talked about, and that would be what this committee would be looking at. And in some contexts, for local governments, at least in Minnesota, their bonds can be used to fund day-to-day obligations. Typically in this state, they're not. But but basically, it's borrowing money and then agreeing to repay the bondholders, the principal, and the interest in the time specified. Bonds can be described, municipal bonds are described in a lot of different ways, and I've heard them talk about state bonds or special district bonds. Sometimes they're described related to the purpose, transportation bonds, building bonds, sewer bonds. Sometimes it's the source of the payment, whether they're general obligation bonds or revenue bonds. Other ways of describing bonds may relate to their maturity structure, whether they're serial or term, their price, the tax status, tax-exempt bonds, or the bulk of the bonds typically issued by the state when issuing state general obligation bonds, the rate or the term.
And I will say, members, there is usually not a bond sale during session. I think there's been an exception to that in the last few years. But at the last bond sale, the bulk of the bonds were sold for 2.05% interest. So it's quite a good time to do some construction. When we hear about the next bond sale, we'll invite all of you to attend if you'd like. It's quite a fascinating little process, and if you're able to attend sometime, I think you would enjoy it. Continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The authority for the state to issue bonds is found in the state constitution and also then the statutes implementing the constitutional provisions. And then there's also federal law that is part of the calculus in issuing bonds, primarily in the tax area, whether they would be tax-exempt bonds or taxable bonds. In the Constitution, you'll find most of the language in Article 11, Sections 4 and 5. The transportation bonds are in the transportation article. The primary purpose for which state general obligation bonds are issued are the capital projects. However, there are other purposes in the Constitution. In general, all state general obligation bonds have to be for a public purpose. All public spending has to be for a public purpose. The obligation, general obligation bonds are those that are authorized in the Constitution, and there is a specific list in the state Constitution of what purposes for which bonds can be issued. Article 11, Section 4, it says the state may contract public debts for which the full faith, credit, and taxing powers may be pledged at the times and in the manner authorized by law, but only for the purposes and subject to the conditions stated in Section 5. And public debt is defined in the Constitution as any obligation payable directly in whole or part from a tax of statewide application. So in other words, it doesn't cover revenue bonds, which are payable from the revenues of a project. The Constitution requires that state general obligation bonds that are issued must be specified in the law authorizing the bonds. And this can be done either by specifying the project specifically, you know, the roof on this building, this portion of a trail. But it can also be done as a statutory program. And for an example of that is the wastewater infrastructure program and some of the other agency programs where it's laid out in statute how the program operates and how bonds will be, bond proceeds will be spent. And then the Constitution limits general obligation bonds to maturities of no more than 20 years. The bonds are typically issued based on the cash flow needs of the state, projects that have already been authorized, and they may be very short term based on a lot of calculations, but it's tied to the projects that are being funded. And so, and I won't go into that too much. I think the people from MMB are better at describing the actual bond issues and maturity rates, but no more than 20 years.
And MMB will be here in a few meetings from now, and they'll go over in much more detail some of that.
And then the last thing I wanted to mention on state general obligation bonds is that a bill authorizing the issuance of state general obligation bonds needs to originate in the House. It has to be a House file, similar to the tax bill. There's some information on that in the information brief on page 7, but the it's based on the bond council's determination that the bonds are backed by the full faith and credit of the tax, full faith credit taxing powers of the state. There is a, the Constitution says that the bonds will be repaid, and if necessary, an unlimited statewide property tax will be levied to pay off the bonds if for some reason the appropriations are unavailable from other sources. And the because of that constitutional provision to levy a tax to make sure these bonds are repaid, bond council says it would not be unreasonable for a court to determine that this is a bill to raise revenue and must originate in the House. As I mentioned before, the primary purpose for which bonds are issued are to, under the Article 11, Section 5, Paragraph A, and that's for acquisition and betterment of public lands and buildings. And here the limitations are it has to be a capital project. Because of the language in the Constitution that talks about acquisition and betterment of public lands and buildings, the capital project is not an accounting definition of capital project. The assets have to be fixed assets, a relatively long life. Over the years, bond council has suggested that at least 10 years useful life. A lot of what you're going to hear me talk about in terms of what we can do and can't do comes from what the bond attorneys for the state have looked at and decided how would a court look at it, because we don't have a lot of court opinions that say what we can do and can't do. So we get our advice on what we can and can't do from state bond council. The capital project, there are some memos that talk about that, but it can't be for repairs and maintenance. It's not that the predictable ongoing repair and maintenance of buildings. It's the improvements to them and the lands. Another example of a capital project that there's a distinction between planning for something and pre-designing a project. And bond funds cannot be used to plan for something. And in common talk, we use the word planning in a lot of different ways. But in the bill, you'll always see planning kind of taken out and pre-design or design put in. And the way to think about it is planning and is more of a should we do it, and pre-design is we've decided to do it. We know where we're going to do it, and now we're kind of scoping out how much, you know, a preliminary look at the design work to figure out how much the whole project might cost. But planning is more of a we don't know yet. And the other example of something that might not, that's not a capital project for the purposes of bond funds, would be looking at alternative alignments, say, of a trail or of a road, because you haven't fixed it in a place. It hasn't been determined where you're doing it, and that's not bondable to do that alternatives analysis.
Representative Ward has a question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dyson, could you, I don't know if it's working, Madam Chair, but that's okay. Ms. Dyson, recently the Attorney General Swanson made some kind of a finding regarding broadband and bonding. Do you recall that finding? As you're talking
Chair
about
and Representative Ward, I'm wondering if I don't know about broadband.
My
the fiber optic infrastructure. There's been some change over time about whether or not that could be deemed an improvement to land and buildings and bondable with geo bonds. It
had to do with the sense of the length of time. You know, the bondability is often, this is a long-term debt, and there was some question about whether fiber optics met that time measure, and so I think there was some work on that, and there has been a finding that in fact that is going to be a bondable expense.
Madam Chair, that's correct. I'm not sure about the term broadband, but the it was very specific to a project for fiber optics infrastructure, and in the early 90s bond council had said this is too much like equipment, it's not a permanent improvement to land and buildings, wires under the ground aren't improving anything, and over time the view changed in terms of is it really an improvement if you have that fiber optic infrastructure on the property, public property. Is that an improvement? And the argument became, well, yeah, it is. And it does have a relatively long useful life. The specific pieces of equipment that might be in the buildings to use the fiber optic would not be bondable independent of a general renovation of the building. So yes, there is a change in thinking over time from the early 90s to now over the use of bond funds for fiber optic infrastructure. Portions of it, not all of it. And there was a bill that was introduced, and actually it's been introduced a few times, that has the language that describes the elements that would be bondable and what wouldn't be.
Our committee administrator tells us there's a memo on this issue, and we'll send that out to members because this is a new direction. I think it would be helpful for people to understand that. So we'll get that memo to committee members.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Continue. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay.
Good explanation.
Continue.
The next element, publicly owned. Bonds issued under the capital improvement provision can only be for publicly owned projects, state or local. What is defined as publicly owned has bond council has made some determinations about what's publicly owned, what isn't. For historical reason purposes, the Minnesota Historical Society owned projects are bondable. But for example, projects owned by the Indian tribes are not, and that is because they are independent sovereign nations. And so, for example, I know there have been requests for funds for like the Leech Lake Tribal College. That's not part of the MNSCU system, or it wasn't. I don't know if it is now or not, but it's not part of the state university system. It's tribal, and it's not eligible for bond funds. So there are some other examples. Federal property, improvements to federal property, not eligible for state bond funds. It's not the state or a political subdivision of the state. And the last point I wanted to make on state general obligation bonds is that under this particular paragraph relating to acquisition and betterment of public land and buildings, it requires a 3/5 vote of both bodies for a bill to pass, so 81 votes in the House to pass a bonding bill. There are other constitutionally authorized uses of state general obligation bonds.
Under I love the first one.
Yes. Actually, what I want the numbers are those are dates that the constitutional provisions were adopted. So the first one to repel invasion and suppress insurrection dates back to 1857 as a use. And I forgot to mention that the bonds, acquisition and betterment of public land and buildings provision was adopted by the state only in 1962. So it's a relatively recent provision. You can see the list there for other uses of GO bonds. There's the certificates of indebtedness, short-term debt, which was also adopted in 62. Refunding bonds, the highway provisions that go back to the Good Roads Movement of the early 1920s. Forestation and preventing and abating forest fires. To construct, improve, and operate airports and other air navigation facilities. And that's one of the examples of operations being a bondable use or a use of bond funds. And I don't know if we have used it that way, but that's in there. You have the authority for the RFA-type programs, extending credit on real estate. Then the railroads, and then as otherwise authorized in the Constitution. The main thing to note on these purposes that are I don't see very often, other than the transportation one, obviously, that these don't require the three-fifths vote, and they do include uses other than improvement to land and buildings. Other sources of capital funding, and these may be part of an omnibus bonding bill coming out of this committee, but they may not. You have the general fund, obviously. That's one way to fund projects. Revenue bonds, they have to be paid back with the revenues of the project. Appropriation bonds, that has been used most recently. Actually, the bonds were just issued in November for the appropriation bonds for the state. Agency bonds that are payable from standing appropriations. The University of Minnesota's biomedical research science facilities are being paid for with those appropriations for the bonds issued by the University of Minnesota. Similarly, the MHFA has some nonprofit housing bonds being paid for with standing appropriations. The Gopher Stadium is another example of that one. Lease purchase financing for equipment and real estate. This is a way of funding the technology infrastructure for the state. And then there are some credit enhancement programs operated by the Public Facilities Authority for local government, schools, cities, and counties. I just wanted to mention there are capital investment guidelines. They are not in law, they are guidelines. And I'm not going to talk about these because Minnesota Management and Budget will talk about these and how they relate to the debt capacity forecast. And similarly, the capital appropriation cancellations they will be discussed at a later meeting by MMB and the report there. The main thing that I just wanted to highlight, just for historical information, it says that it's for projects that are authorized more than 4 years ago. When this law was originally enacted in 1995, it was 7 years, and then it got shortened to 5 years, and now it's 4 years. Some other topics I just wanted to briefly cover. GO bonds are for projects that have not yet been started. I think it comes up frequently, particularly with local governments that you may be working with for projects, that the bond funds cannot be used to reimburse a local government for a project that's already been done. And this relates to federal tax law primarily. But if you have a local government that's looking for that, or they want to start a project early and get reimbursed, tell them no. And if they want more information or want to talk about it some more, the staff at MMB is very good at explaining more about this, but basically start with saying no. The role of bond counsel, as I mentioned earlier, in order for bonds to be sold by the state needs to have the bond attorneys say, give a good opinion of the legality and also explain what the tax status of the bonds will be, whether they're tax exempt or taxable. And without that, the bonds really aren't marketable. And so the problem that the legislature faces is that we don't have a lot of hard and fast court opinions to guide us on what is bondable and what is not. What we have are the bond attorneys to help us sort through whether or not they can give a good opinion. And the Attorney General is the bond counsel for the state and also retains outside bond counsel, particularly for tax analysis of the bonds. Use of state bond finance property. The main thing is to know that there are restrictions on the use of state bond finance property, and this applies whether or not there is just a little bit of money that went into pre-design or if the entire project is state bond financed. And it used to be that this applied for all time, that the restrictions on the use of the property applied for all time. Now, under some new guidelines, the restrictions disappear after a time equal to 125% of the useful life of the property, or if it is sold following procedures that are laid out in statute that, as they like to say, cleanse the property. This issue mostly arises in the context of local governments that have received state bond funds for a project. And so I just wanted to highlight that, that there are some restrictions on the use of the property. Non-state match requirements. The main thing I wanted to mention here is that if a project has bond funds for the project, but it doesn't cover the cost of doing the whole project as described in the bill, the project won't get any money until there is a commitment that will fully fund the entire project. So when, whether or not the rider in the bill says a match is required, if the money isn't sufficient to complete the project the way it's described, some money is going to have to come up from somewhere to finish that project, or it won't go forward. Let's see what else. The last thing I just wanted to mention on this page, some comparisons of state and local bonding, particularly for members that come out of local government. I often get a question of, well, we were able to issue local bonds for whatever the purpose was. And there are some differences. In the information brief, I have some explanations, but the referendum requirement. The state does not have a referendum requirement or authority on this. Local governments, the starting point is you have to have a referendum to issue debt. There are a lot of exceptions in law for local governments as well. The limit on net debt, state statute limits local government debt, and sometimes you'll see bills that say this purpose is outside of debt limit, but there is a limit in statute as a starting point for local governments. The state does not have a statutory or constitutional limit on debt, with some exception for some railroad. Public ownership, state bonds must, geo bonds are for publicly owned projects, as I talked about earlier. Local governments can issue debt that might be owned by private entities. And then purposes, there are some differences in the purposes. The legislature gets to enact laws that govern the purposes for local governments. The Constitution limits the state so that in some respects the local governments have broader authority than the state does. I won't go into this very much, but there are other entities at the state level that issue debt. As I mentioned before, MHFA, the Housing Finance Agency, has the mortgage revenue bonds, and the University of Minnesota Public Facilities Authority for the various infrastructure programs that they have. Anyway, there are a lot of other entities, a lot. There are other entities that can issue debt at the state level. And I think that was all I intended to cover today. There's resources.
And what I would just do, members, if you have the information brief in front of you, I just wanted to call a few to your attention. On page 4, she talked about the agency appropriation bonds, where we, in a few instances, enacted a standing appropriation to pay another entity an amount sufficient to pay their debt service. The University of Minnesota has two of those, as she mentioned. And at one point, when the university wanted to build a series of research buildings, they argued that it's very difficult for them to recruit the researchers that they need in a brief period of time, that they need some period of time for that recruitment, and that it would help to have a longer, some more advanced opportunity to bond for those facilities. That was a very controversial thing because, of course, we were giving them an opportunity that we weren't giving to anyone else, including Minsky. And so we finally said, well, if you did this for the Gopher football stadium, couldn't you do it for the research buildings as well, where you do the bonding and then we pay the debt service? Now, you want to be careful about that, because the higher ed committee then, when they start their budget, that comes right off the top, because we've done that already. And so that can be an unpopular thing with chair. The same with housing. The purpose, when we gave that authority to the Housing Finance Agency, we used to just do public housing. But more and more, there were nonprofits like Lutheran Social Service and Wilder and others who were willing to be partners and to bring some other resources to bear in some sort of public-private partnerships. And those seemed to be smart things for us to do. And the way we did that then was through this standing appropriation to MHFA, and then they do the bonding, and they don't have the same kinds of rules we would. And so that those are the three instances, I think, where we have used that. But I think it has to be used with some caution, yes.
On that particular point, Madam Chair, is that, I guess, two questions. Number one is, were they able to secure roughly the same interest rates that we were, or that we have been? You referenced the 2.05%.
I'm told better. Better interest rates at the University of Minnesota.
Well, perhaps we should have them issue all of this.
We'll talk to them about that.
The second question, thank you for that. The second question is, are we alone in doing that? Are there other states that are taking that? And perhaps I should turn my gaze to the left here.
Are we alone there with that?
Are there others that are taking the same approach?
Agency
other states I'm talking about? And I didn't mean to catch you off guard if you haven't done your 50-state survey to find out what everybody else is doing. Probably hard enough just to keep track of Minnesota.
Madam Chair and Representative Atkins, yes, other states do a lot of different things, the financing. A different way for me to answer the question is that every state has its own constitutional restrictions on issuing debt, so it's very hard to compare state to state, but appropriation bonds are issued by other states and probably by other state political subdivisions and entities. So I think that might be also a good question for the folks from MMB, but I know in looking at the issuance of state appropriation bonds, some of the models were taken from other states. So
we made a note to alert MMB to that question to give us some history on that. Representative Detmer, yeah. Is it to this point?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. But regarding the bonding, you listed an example of the agency bond, like the University of Minnesota. Could you give us maybe an example of how these other bonds are used, what type of projects?
I can give you a few examples. Let's see. Who did I have? Well, the Housing Finance Agency, those are the mortgage revenue bonds for, they have the first-time home buyer programs. And then the Public Facilities Authority revenue bonding, again, that's for wastewater infrastructure primarily. It's probably one of the biggest. And then they pair that with federal funds. They do loans and grants, but the revenue bonding, they have to get back the loan funds to repay the funding or the bonds holders. The Tobacco Securitization Authority from 2011, that was a state authority created during that special session to issue state revenue bonds that were payable from the tobacco revenues, which they're revenue bonds because they are not being repaid by a tax of statewide application. Yeah. Those have since been refunded with the state appropriation bonds that were sold in November. The Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, they can probably give you much better information. All of these agencies can give you better information on the details of theirs, but I think MNSCU has the authority to issue revenue bonds for revenue-generating facilities, and I'm thinking dormitories would be the primary example. Mm-hmm. The Rural Finance Authority, that's the beginning farmer programs, loans to farmers for their operations, and I'm not up on my RFA programs, but and the State Armory Building Commission, the same amount of money has sort of been outstanding for a while, and I don't know that much about what that money is used for. It's a very small, relatively speaking, outstanding debt that commission has, so I'm not sure if armories have been funded with that recently, but those are some examples.
Madam Chair, just a question maybe of the Chair. Is any of these bonds have priority over other bonds in terms of payback? That was a question that came from a constituent.
There are different lengths of time, given the nature of the bonds, but I don't know that priority in terms of some being paid back. It's not a matter of priority. It's just a different tool.
Madam Chair and Representative Denver, that's correct. Each of these are they would have their own promises to the bondholders about how they will be repaid and what is the source of the repayment and how that you know what are the backups if any. Something like the standing appropriations for the University of Minnesota for the Gopher Stadium and for the biomedical science. University of Minnesota has made their promises on how they will repay the bonds. The state has said we have a standing appropriation, but we can repeal it and or unallot it, and then the university is on its own. So there, each one of the issues has its own set of promises, so they're not ranked against each other or against the general state geodebt. Is that what you were?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Rudall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dyson, I'm just wondering if we have any type of percentage breakdown on bonds. I mean, I would assume that general obligation are the most, and then you know, revenue bonds. Any idea what the percentage is?
Now, I believe that MMB is going to, I don't know if MMB is here, MMB is, I think, going to break that down in terms of percentages. So we'll get to that answer when MMB is before us.
Madam Chair, the state GO bonds are the bulk. I mean, the single largest outstanding debt is going to be with state general obligation bonds. But, there are other large amounts.
And then, members, if you'd look just briefly at page 5, we're going to be spending a significant amount of time when MMB is here. But I thought it might be interesting to just give a little bit of history about the guidelines, which didn't exist, as I understand, until the Perpich administration. And there was a sort of a very informal in a corridor in New York City just before they were going into a room where they thought, oh, it might be a good idea to have a guideline. And so they came up with 3% of the general fund, which we lived with for a long time. But the point is, it wasn't very helpful to any of the rating agencies because comparing state to state isn't easy with the general fund. Every state is so different in terms of what it even includes in the general fund. So that 3% of the general fund wasn't a very meaningful figure. So in the Pawlenty administration, he reworked them, and those are the ones you see. They date relatively recent, and one of the things MMB will do when they're here is give us what our current status is in relation to these current guidelines, and I think that will be helpful for us. Then on page 6, just a word, because I don't think we're talking about this any other time. Some people might think our state bond ratings have something to do with the level of our GO bonding. That almost is never referenced. Instead, the rating agencies look at our overall economy and the state's financial management, and they have always given us good marks because we have a diversified economy. We don't depend on one industry and thus would be so vulnerable. When they downgraded us, as you see at the bottom of the second paragraph, the rating agencies pointed to what they viewed as the state's failure to address the structural imbalance and an ongoing reliance of non-recurring measures to balance its budget. So it's very much, those ratings are very much related to not only the condition of our economy, but how we deal with it as we pass our budget. And then just one more word, because I saw a little bit of confusion when she was talking about the University of Minnesota in Minsky. On page 8, the second paragraph, since 1992, state capital appropriations for the U of M and Minsky have required a non-state contribution. This has not included appropriations for what's the asset preservation, HEPR. Now, I've always thought that's a little bit of a catch-22, apologies to our systems, because it does mean that anything they can qualify as asset preservation, that is an advantage because they don't have to pay the local share. We pay that in its entirety. Not that they would ever do that, of course, but... so for the university, the appropriations are intended to cover approximately two-thirds of the cost of each project. The remaining cost must be paid from university sources. We handle MNSCU and the University of Minnesota a bit differently in terms of the bookkeeping for that, but both of them have that two-third, one-third requirement. It seemed to me when I saw that, I think you suggested maybe that was a little bit of confusion with HEPR. So that is, any more concluding remarks, Ms. Dyson?
No, Madam Chair.
Any further questions here? Who? Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, and probably either of you can answer this, but since I'm new, on pre-design, the state and this committee has often forwarded projects that have pre-design, and as I was listening, I was kind of interested to hear that there are some then requirements, even if pre-design dollars are used for the remainder of that project or for some time limit. Does this committee have any, and the state have any policy or practice that would say if the state chooses to use state funds for pre-design that there is any sort of obligation or message sending that that then is of future interest in a full bonding project if you just do pre-design?
And I'll handle a bit before we get to that one, one other piece of it. This is advice if anybody is drafting bills, just never use the word planning for that early work because planning is not bondable. And pre-design and design, a very different thing is. So to her question, do we presume in your history, once we've paid for pre-design and design, do we? Is there some sort of moral obligation that the state, I think that's the point of your question.
Madam Chair, I have heard it described that way, that funding pre-design implies that there is an intention to proceed. I can't say that that really is a question for the members, but I have heard members say that that is what they expect.
You know, my sense would be sometimes you discover something in the pre-design and design stage that says we don't want to move forward with this or we don't have an interest in it. In the case of, I know in the case of MNSCU, very often in a first year, a first go-round, they ask for the pre-design and design so that they're ready then for the next one. You know, we don't like a lot of money sitting out there unspent, so we would rather just initially fund the pre-design and design to give them that takes a little bit of time and then follow through with the construction. So I would venture to guess that there have been times that we might have funded pre-design and design and for whatever purpose reason we choose not to go forward with the project.
Madam Chair, on page 6 of the packet, there's capital appropriations and cancellations and a report for January 1st from MMB. And I'm just wondering if next Thursday on the 17th when MMB comes, if they're going to be prepared to talk about that, if we might have a chance to take a peek at that ahead of time. I know there's a lot of interest on that, particularly if it's broken out what it is, new members. It's a kind of a look at what did we give you before, agency, what are the projects, how much of it is spent, and how much of it has yet to be spent. So there's a lot of interest in that from members.
MMB is here, and if I know it's ready already, and so and you've already sent it to us, so we actually could probably just forward it to committee members. So if you'd make a note, we will forward the cancellation report early if you want to take a look at it. But they are going to be discussing that.
Thank you.
At the meeting. Any other questions? I've offered if you want individual meetings to just have a little more time to discuss something to set up an appointment. We're seeing a couple of committee members about that, or if you have a particular project that you know already that you'd like to talk about and have some conversation about those that is available to you. Representative Wagenius has a group of university professors coming in on Tuesday, January 15th, and she offered, because a portion of what they're talking about, particularly Mark Seeley, from a weather perspective, if you watched what happened in Duluth and if you watched what happened on the East Coast, the nature of weather and increasing intensity of storms has had some great effect on infrastructure. And so at least one of the things that the professors will be dealing with, and I think Mark Seeley specifically, are those implications on weather events on water, water infrastructure, other transportation certainly, and they'll discuss it from that perspective. So that's a joint meeting, and I think they also added legacy, so come early if you want a chair, apparently. It's going to be a fairly significant group. And then MMB. The following week. So, any other questions? Do we have anything else we need to do? Okay, meeting is adjourned.